The story is told of a man who joined a monastery. This was going back quite a ways. And in addition to the vows of poverty and celibacy that he took on a year of silence. And so they allowed him 2 years, a word which he would, 2 years, a two words, I cannot speak, 2 words a year, which he would be allowed to speak at his annual review. So he very devoutly took the entire first year in absolute silence. At the end of the year, he came to the review board and he said, "Bed hard." Another year went by and he very devoted his life to learning the scriptures and studying, but remained silent. At the end of the year, he came to another review and he said, "Food cold." Spent the third year in absolute silence. He comes before this board again. He says, "I quit." To which the monastery leader responded, "Your decision does not surprise us. You've been doing nothing but complaining since you got here." If only we heard complaints once a year in the church, I would be a very happy leader. Let me preface this message with this. This is not intended at any one person. This is intended at God's people. Sure, sometimes it's frustrating as a leader, as a pastor, and I get tired of negativity and complaining inside and outside of the church, both. But I want us to see God's response this morning to complaining. We've been looking at attitudes of the mind. This week I'm going to transition. We'll flip back and forth as specifically I'd make the distinction. This is an attitude of the heart. It is a disgruntled or complaining type attitude. So we're going to talk about that this morning. But I'm sure this message probably won't apply to most of you here, and I'm sure that none of you have a problem with complaining. So make sure if you know somebody that does complain, you pick up a CD for them. Okay. What are things that we often get caught complaining about? I think the list would be way too long for us to even start this morning. But I have put together a few that probably should strike a chord with most of us in this room. How about your job? We've never complained about our job or our bosses, our superiors, have we? Or how about our home? We're completely satisfied with the amount of space we have and that everything works according to plan all the time and that it's all perfect. Or our children, the way they turned out or what they're wearing. We never complain about the way they act in front of people in public. Or we never complain about our government and the leadership or the decisions that they make, do we? We never complain about our supervisors, the weather, or our income, or our taxes, or the neighbors. We certainly never complain about each other because we're Christians and we don't do that in church. We don't complain about politicians, or we don't complain about that rude driver. Yeah, there's only one rude driver in Blacksburg. I found them on the way to church today. I was coming down the highway and they cut me off. We never would complain about that, would we? We complain when it's hot. We complain when it's cold. We complain when it's rainy. We complain when it's snowing. We complain when we have poor health. We complain when we have a lack of free time or how we didn't get to hear our favorite hymn last Sunday. We might complain about the traffic. We might complain about the leak in the roof. We might complain about the dirty dishes or the mortgage payment or another car repair. Certainly the furnace that goes out. But I am sure that this room is full of mature Christians and that's only me that ever complains about any of those things. Am I right? Complain. As I like to start with definitions so we're on the same page, here's your definition for complain. To express dissatisfaction or annoyance about a state of affairs or an event. Very simple and concise. This is from Merriam-Webster. Express dissatisfaction or annoyance about a state of affairs or an event. Okay? I want to distinguish. Grumble. To complain or protest about something in a bad-tempered but typically muted way. I have also a definition up here of whine. To give or make a long, high-pitched complaining cry or sound. Even reading the definition is annoying. I read that and honestly I thought, wow, that's really annoying. You can almost just imagine it. Maybe it's just because I'm a parent of young children and I can imagine this whining. But just this high-pitched, I have to do that? That's what it sounds like to God. We can go home now. That was my most annoying sound in the world, for those that have seen the movie. Okay, for those that have the King James, the authorized version. You do not have the word complain or grumble. You have this word murmur. And since we don't know what murmur means, I also looked that up for you. And it's really in Greek, all joking aside, the word is translated complain or murmur. But I just found a good little nugget as I was looking at the definitions. Murmur obviously is a verb as we're using it in context this morning, to murmur, to complain. It is also a noun, which refers to a medical condition. Let me read it to you verbatim. A condition in which the heart produces or is apt to produce a reoccurring sound indicative of disease or damage. That'll preach. A condition in which the heart produces a sound indicative of disease or damage. We're talking about attitudes of the heart, in which your heart is producing the sound of something like a disease inside. Murmur. You can take that one. I give you a complete authorization to reuse it. Just make sure you don't tell the person that it came from me. Okay. I believe complaining, in essence, is the gross unthankfulness for God and what He has done. It is ungratefulness for the station of life that God has placed us in. The Greek word translated complainer means literally one who is discontented with his lot in life. One who is discontent with what God has given him, you see. See, it is interesting that we are quite arguably the most indulged society. And yet we are also the most discontent society. The more people have, it seems, the more they have to be discontent about. Well, I can't believe my car makes a squeal when I start it. I can't believe I have to stop and get gas twice a week. I wish I had better gas mileage. I can't believe that this gutter, there's clogged with leaves and the HOA won't come by and fix it. These are the little things that we, you know what? Some people would be happy to have a roof over their head, and we're worried about the gutter. Quite honestly, the church is full of complainers. I want to start out this morning and take a quick look through history of Bible complainers. The Israelites were professionals in this area. Let's turn to Exodus chapter 14. We're going to read a lot of different passages, so I didn't write them all down. We are not going to read three chapters straight. You probably, some of you are cheering a little bit inside, but we are going to look from Exodus chapter 14 to 17 and then get into Numbers a little bit. Now, keep in mind that the children of Israel had been in bondage to Egypt for over 400 years when Moses had led them out of Egypt. They had just seen the hand of God move mightily with these plagues and of what struck Egypt with, and then they come to this, they're escaping and they see Israel or Egypt closing in behind them. Yet they still did not trust God. Let's look starting in Exodus 14, starting in verse 10. As Pharaoh drew near, the sons of Israel looked, and behold, the Egyptians were marching after them, and they became very frightened. So the sons of Israel cried out to the Lord. They said to Moses, "It is because there were no graves in Egypt that you have taken us away to die in the wilderness? Why have you dealt with us in this way, bringing us out of Egypt? Is this not the word that we spoke to you in Egypt, saying, 'Leave us alone that we may serve the Egyptians'? For it would have been better for us to serve the Egyptians than to die in the wilderness." What a heart of gratefulness, don't you think? You probably know the story. The Red Sea is divided. God miraculously allows them to walk across safely. In the beginning of chapter 15, they begin this great praise of God, which we sing in various types of songs occasionally. The horse and riders thrown into the sea. But it does not have a lasting impact on their life. Let's skip down to verse 22. Then Moses led Israel from the Red Sea, We haven't made it very far, note. And they went out into the wilderness of Shur. And they went 3 days into the wilderness and found no water. Now, you think back just 3 days, they're complaining that there's too much water and they can't get through it. We've now made it 3 days. God has delivered them out of the hand of Egypt and divided waters miraculously right before their eyes. And here they are complaining that there is no water. Verse 23. When they came to Marah, they could not drink the waters of Marah, for they were bitter. Therefore, it was named Marah. Then he cried out, verse 24. So the people grumbled at Moses, saying, "What shall we drink? What shall we drink, Moses? You've led us out of Egypt. It would have been better for us to be serving the Egyptians. Now we have nothing to drink. We're getting thirsty. And this water's terrible, Moses. What is your plan now?" You can almost imagine, you'd almost want to take part in it. We're out in the hot desert, Moses. 25. Then he cried out to the Lord, and the Lord showed him a tree. And he threw it into the waters, and the waters became sweet. Now, I'm not an expert in chemistry. I guess I could call on somebody to come up and talk about this a little bit. But I'm pretty sure that I would not necessarily have the same effect of throwing a tree into water and making it sweet unless it was divine. I don't think that's how a Brita filter works, is that the water goes through and it just magically sweetens the water up. This is not that. This isn't a giant Brita filter in the desert. This is another miracle that's taking place. There is no water to drink, and they come to this nasty pool. Oh, look at that tree. Throw it in there. That'll work. Another miracle. Wouldn't you think they would start to get it? God provides for their needs and gives them water. Skip down to the next chapter, 16, verse 1. Then they set out from Elim, and all the congregation of the sons of Israel came to the wilderness of Sin, which is between Elim and Sinai, on the 15th day of the second month after their departure from the land of Egypt. The whole congregation of the sons of Israel grumbled against Moses and Aaron in the wilderness. The sons of Israel said to them, "Would that we had died by the Lord's hand in the land of Egypt, when we sat by the pots of meat, when we ate bread to the full. For you have brought us out of the wilderness to kill this whole assembly with hunger." Don't they just make that sound like a picnic? Here they were in slavery for 400 years, getting whipped and having to work out in the hot sun building some stupid pyramids so that one guy can get buried under this thing that takes hundreds of years to build. And they want to go back. They say, "Oh, we got to fill our stomachs with this bread and with this meat. It was so good. Take us back. Why are you bringing us out here?" What a picture. It's like, was your life before Christ in the slavery of sin better off than it is now in freedom? Yet we complain and find ways to complain in the church, don't we? "God, why aren't you providing for this?" Have we gotten our eyes off of the slavery that we used to be stuck in before Christ? That'll preach for those taking notes. You can write that down. Exodus 16, verse 4. Let's see what happens. Then the Lord said to Moses, "Behold, I will rain bread from heaven for you, and the people shall go out and gather a day's portion every day, and I may test them whether or not they will walk in my instruction." And he continues to go on and talks about a 6 day, you grab a double portion for the Sunday, for the day of rest. Okay, so here they are. There's no water. He gives them water. There's no food. God says, "You know what? I'm not only going to give you materials to make your food, but I'm going to bake it for you. I'm going to give you this substance, which is supernaturally equipped with all the nutrients you need, and it's not even going to taste bad. And it's going to rain down from heaven. All you have to do is go outside your tent and pick it up." Man, wouldn't that just be awesome? Wouldn't that be great? All you're thinking, "I never have to cook again. I never have to cook again." How long do you think it'd take before your husband complained about the same taste over and over and over again? "Oh, God, why can't you just put it in the pot for me or right on the dinner? If you're going to rain it down, why can't you just set the table for me?" Watch what happens. They find something to complain about. It's really amazing. Let's skip to chapter 17. Verse 1, "Then all the congregation of the sons of Israel journeyed by stages from the wilderness of Sin according to the command of the Lord and camped at Rephidim. And there was no water for the people to drink. I thought we already went over this one. Did I skip back a chapter? Therefore, the people quarreled with Moses and said, "Give us water that we may drink." And Moses said to them, "Why do you quarrel with me? Why do you test the Lord?" But the people thirsted there for water. They grumbled against Moses and said, "Why now have you brought us up from Egypt to kill us and our children and our livestock with thirst?" They never stopped complaining. And notice here that they were testing God with their complaints. That is some dangerous territory to navigate into. Here you are, if you recount the story, the account of how they're being navigated through the desert. Moses didn't have a big GPS. Well, he did kind of, I guess. It was a cloud by day and a fire by night. So here they are out in the desert. You're testing God and you're seeing God in this column of fire. I don't know if I'd be testing God while there's this big pillar of fire burning right behind us. Be like, "Hey God, watch what I can do." You laugh, but aren't we just like him? We see God's work in provision, and yet we turn around and we soon forget. Look at verse 5. Then the Lord said to Moses, "Pass before the people and take with you some of the elders of Israel and take in your hand your staff with which you struck the Nile and go. Behold, I will stand before you there on the rock at Horeb, and you shall strike the rock and water will come out of it that the people may drink." And Moses did so in the sight of the elders of Israel. He named the place Massah in Meribah because of the quarrel of the sons of Israel and because they tested the Lord, saying, "Is the Lord among us or not?" Look at how fast this progression goes. It goes from a little bit of fear, we're going to die, to we're going to die of thirst, to we're going to die of hunger and thirst, to now our children and livestock are going to die, to now, is the Lord even among us? Now from here we need to go over to the book of Numbers. You can flip there, Numbers chapter 11, two books to your right. But before we do, I want to bring your attention to something. Up until this point, it seems like God has put up with this complaining from the people. There's something that's significant that happens between here and where we're going to pick up, and that is this. Moses goes up Mount Sinai, and he receives the tablets, and God goes into a covenant with his people. Now, there was already a covenant that's promised to Abraham long back, and that's why they are seeking out this promised land. But here they are given the commandments and instructed on how to live their life in between where we're picking up now. We're going to begin to see a different story in response to the complaining of Israel. I believe the picture of Israel coming out of Egypt is a picture of salvation. And after God gives them his law, he starts to discipline them for this sin of complaining. Chapter 11, verse 1. Now the people became like those who complain of adversity in the hearing of the Lord. And when the Lord heard it, his anger was kindled, and the fire of the Lord burned among them and consumed some of the outskirts of the camp. The people therefore cried out to Moses, and Moses prayed to the Lord, and the fire died out. So the name of that place was called Taberah because of the fire the Lord burned among them. You thought I was joking about that pillar of fire and testing them. Read it. It says that some of them died on the outskirts of the camp by fire. God's not having it anymore. God's judgment begins to fall on his people for their complaining. Let's look down at verse 4. The rabble, this group that is left who are among them, had greedy desires. And also the sons of Israel wept again and said, "Who will give us meat to eat?" Here they are. People are dying on the outskirts of the camp by fire, and they find something else to complain about. We remember the fish which we used to eat to eat free in Egypt, the cucumbers and the melons and the leeks and the onions and the garlic. But now our appetite is gone. There is nothing at all to look at except this manna. God's about ready to pour out his judgment again. If you have subtitles in your Bible, it's perhaps at around verse 10, you have this section called the Complaint of Moses. It's interesting that Moses then turns and complains to God about all these people you have left me with. Let's continue on. I told you they were professional complainers. Verse 18 of chapter 11. Say to the people, consecrate yourselves for tomorrow, and you shall eat meat. For you have wept in the ears of the Lord, saying, oh, that someone would give us meat to eat, for we were well off in Egypt. Therefore the Lord will give you meat, and you shall eat. You shall eat not one day, not 2 days, not 5 days, nor 10 days, nor 20 days, but a whole month, until it comes out of your nostrils and becomes loathsome to you, because you have rejected the Lord who is among you and have wept before him, saying, why did we ever leave Egypt? Skip down to verse 31. Now there went forth a wind from the Lord, and it brought quail from the sea, and let them fall beside the camp, about a day's journey on this side and a day's journey on the other side, all around the camp, about 2 cubits deep. A cubit is about 18 inches. This is almost 3 feet of quail. Moses wasn't joking about it coming out of their nostrils. 2 cubits deep on the surface of the ground. The people spent all day and all night and all the next day and gathered the quail. He who gathered least gathered 10 homers. And they spread them out for themselves all around the camp. While the meat was still between their teeth, before it was chewed, the anger of the Lord was kindled against the peoples, and the Lord struck the people with a very severe plague. Skip down to verse 1 of chapter 12. It continues. Then Miriam and Aaron, brothers of Moses, sister of Moses, spoke against Moses because of the Cushite woman whom he had married, for he had married a Cushite woman. And they said, has the Lord indeed spoken only through Moses? Has he not spoken through us as well? And the Lord heard it. This is not an easy thing to preach on, but we need to hear it this morning. There are people all over churches that want a platform to speak. Pastors and lay alike. There are pastors just as equally that are looking for a place to just talk. But let me tell you something. Just because you don't like your pastor, or just because you don't agree with all the words that he says, doesn't mean that he is not God's mouthpiece. And it certainly does not mean that God wants you to start an uprising because of your lousy opinions. I thought I'd get a whole lot more amens. No, I didn't. Skip down to verse 9. So the anger of the Lord burned against them, and he departed. But when the cloud had withdrawn from over the tent, behold, Miriam was leprous, as white as snow. As Aaron turned toward Miriam, behold, she was leprous. Moses ends up crying out to God. And God allows her to stay leprous for 7 days, and then she's welcomed back into the camp. Chapter 13 is about the 12 spies being sent out into the promised land. Okay, we're going to fast forward a bit. And if you recount, Joshua and Caleb came back with a good report. Let's go take the land. God has given it to us. 10 come back and say, we look like giants. Here's the result of it. The people are afraid, chapter 14, verse 1. Then all the congregation lifted up their voices and cried, and the people wept that night. All the sons of Israel grumbled against Moses and Aaron, and the whole congregation said to them, would that we had died in the land of Egypt, or would that we had died in this wilderness. It's just really mind-boggling, isn't it? Skip down to verse 26. The Lord spoke to Moses and Aaron, saying, how long shall I bear with this evil congregation who are grumbling against me? I have heard their complaints of the sons of Israel, which they are making against me. Say to them, as I live, says the Lord, just as you have spoken in my hearing, so I will surely do to you. Your corpses will fall in this wilderness, even all your numbered men, according to the complete number from 20 years old and upward, who have grumbled against me. God pours out his judgment, says nobody that is above 20 is going to enter in. They're going to die here in this desert. Why? Because of their grumbling. I hope you are beginning to see just how serious complaining is. But we're not done yet. Chapter 16, we have another rebellion, another rebellious uprising of Korah, Dathan, and Abiram. Here they are, and they're not happy with the way Moses is leading. Let's look at verse 3. They assembled together against Moses and Aaron and said to them, "You have gone far enough, for all the congregation are holy, every one of them, and the Lord is in their midst. So why do you exalt yourselves above the assembly of the Lord?" When Moses heard this, he fell on his face. And he spoke to Korah and all his company, saying, "Tomorrow morning the Lord will show who is his and who is holy, and will bring him near to himself. Even the one whom he will choose, he will bring near to himself." Let's look down to verse 31. As he finished speaking all these words, this is the next day, the ground that was under them split open, and the earth opened its mouth and swallowed them up in their households. This is Korah. And all the men who belonged to Korah with their possessions. So they and all that belonged to them went down alive to Sheol, and the earth closed over them, and they perished from the midst of the assembly. All Israel who were around them fled at their outcry, for they said, "The earth may swallow us up." Fire also came forth from the Lord and consumed the 250 men who were offering the incense. Don't shoot the messenger, I'm just reading the word of God. Israel's response to this is quite fascinating. Rather than fear, they resort to complaining. Number 16, 41. But on the next day, all the congregation of the sons of Israel grumbled against Moses and Aaron, saying, "You are the ones who have caused the death of the Lord's people." They're not getting it. You think you would start to get it by now. Verse 44, "And the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, 'Get away from among this congregation, that it may consume them instantly.' Then they fell on their faces. Moses said to Aaron, 'Take your censer and put it in the fire from the altar and lay incense on it and bring it quickly to the congregation and make atonement for them. For wrath has gone forth from the Lord. The plague has begun.' Then Aaron took it as Moses had spoken and ran into the midst of the assembly. For behold, the plague had begun among the people. So he put it on, He put on the incense and made atonement for the people. He took his stand between the dead and the living so that the plague was checked. But those who had died by the plague were 14,700 beside those who died on the account of Korah. Then Aaron returned to Moses at the doorway of the tent of meeting, for the plague had been checked." What's interesting, Paul references this account in 1 Corinthians 10, verses 9 and 10. He says it this way, "Nor let us try the Lord or test as some of them did and were destroyed by the serpents, nor grumble as some of them did and were destroyed by the destroyer." Here's a picture. There's two words in the Bible, or two names. Two people are given the names of the destroyer. One is Satan in Revelation, the Abaddon. He's the destroyer. But there's also a reference here, as we see, that there is a destroying angel, which is the same angel of the Passover. So this angel, as he passed over Egypt and slew all the firstborn, Paul makes reference to and says, this is the destroyer who killed the 14,700 Jews. 40 years later, their punishment again was to die in the wilderness. Everyone that was above 20. Numbers 21, verses 4 and 5. "Then they sent out from Mount Hor by the way of the Red Sea to go around the land of Edom, and the people became impatient because of the journey. The people spoke against God and Moses, 'Why have you brought us up out of Egypt to die in the wilderness? For there is no food and no water, and we loathe this miserable food.'" Tisk, 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 verse 6. "The Lord sent fiery serpents among the people, and they bit the people, so that many of the people of Israel died." A few things we can glean from these passages. Discontent causes complaining. Being dissatisfied with food or water or your situation or what God has led you in can lead you into complaining. See, Christians are taught to be content with what God has given us. We're going to quickly go through these because we got a lot more of the message to get to. Selfishness is a second cause of complaining. Selfish people want their way and do not like it one bit if they do not get it. Therefore, they complain. Complaining gives place to the devil. Complaining ignores God's potential. Just like Israel. You think about the report, just take for instance the report from the spies as they come back. They chose to complain rather than to trust God for the potential he wanted them to walk into. The devil thrives in an atmosphere of complaining. Complaining leads to self-pity. Complaining left unchecked usually breeds rebellion or mutiny. We see that with Aaron and Miriam and Korah. A complaining spirit is quick to jump to the wrong conclusion. These are just little pieces I picked out of each of those passages we just read. Let's continue on. Rather than condemning Israel for their worthless ability to pick up on the fact that God does not like complaining, we need to look at our own lives. See, because I believe complaining is a symptom of a deep-seated spiritual problem. It's a failure to trust God and a failure to be submissive to his providential provision in your life. God hates complaining. God hates complaining. Let's look at our text. No, none of those were our text. Philippians chapter 2. We have a text. I grew up in Culpeper County, went to a small Christian school, Culpeper Christian. There's a man who came by once a month to do our weekly chapel service, and he brought this great felt board, and he would tell these stories. Just about every single week, he would say this, and we'd repeat it. God hates complaining. I now know what he meant. Philippians chapter 2, let's look at verse 14. Do some things without grumbling or disputing. Oh, thank you, sorry. My eyes got crossed. Do all things without grumbling, or disputing, or complaining, or murmuring, or whining. So that you will prove yourselves to be blameless and innocent, children of God above reproach in the midst of a crooked and perverse generation, among whom you appear as lights in the world. Our text says, do all things. Now, most Christians do some things without complaining. I've met a few that can't even do that. But you've got to remember here, for Paul, complaining was a seemingly legitimate response to the circumstances he is in when he's writing this epistle. If you remember Philippians, he's writing from a prison. So here Paul is in jail. And he says, do all things without complaining. Doesn't that change your perspective a little bit? The problem is, we as Christians need to do all things, not just some things, not just what you choose. Make no mistake, complaining is a sin, or at its very best, it leads you into sin, so that you will prove yourself or become blameless and pure. Let's flip that around. You become pure and blameless if you do all things without complaining and disputing. I don't think we like the thought of that, do we? Can you tell me what good complaining accomplishes or what it does? Does it make you feel better? Does it help you get what you want? Does it make you feel superior knowing that if you whine about something long enough, you'll get your way and somebody will respond to it? Why is it that we as Christians complain and dispute? I think it's because so many Christians are self-centered rather than God-centered. In other words, we have fleshly eyes. What we miss in verse 15 is that we need to keep in mind we are not to complain about anything, period, because, there's a because here, we are witnesses to the world so that we can be blameless in this worlds among this crooked generation. Do we live among a crooked and perverse generation? Stop complaining. It's your witness. It's your testimony. Who wants to walk into a visit a church if all they hear is you talk about how bad the pastor is or how long the sermon is or how bad the worship is or how hot or cold it is or how there's nobody really loves each other and there's a lot of backbiting? Who would want to try out a church like that? Now, I certainly would not. Let's go back to the report of the 10 spies. I said that I believe this is, we as Christians have a problem with complaining because we get our eyes off of God. Here the spies had gotten their eyes off of the promises of God. They didn't trust the man that God had put in charge to lead them into the promised land. And here's the worst part. An entire generation missed out on the blessing that God had for them because of their distrust in God. That'll preach. Do we live like that today? An entire generation missed out on the blessings of God because of their father's distrust in God. That's the problem with complaining, is that are you leaving a generation behind you that is going to miss out on the blessings because you've been complaining? What do I mean by that? There was a doctor, this is a true story. I feel like I have to preface those statements because people are looking for the punchline and they have to laugh. This is true. There was a doctor that was getting ready to retire, and a patient came in and was talking to him, and they got talking about his children. He said that my three children are all involved in church and very plugged in and still following the Lord, and they were in their 30s and 40s. And this patient who had come in was very intrigued, and he was just recounting his perspective of the situation. He said, I asked him, why is it, do you think, that your children grew up and are still following the Lord and involved? Now, I don't want anyone to take offense to this because your child is not following the ways of the Lord. This is not necessarily the cause. But this was the doctor's response. He said, my wife and I chose from the very beginning to never talk bad about the church or anyone in it, period. And I just wonder, this next generation of children, how many of them walk away from the church because of our attitudes when we were making them come to church? It's one thing to bring your children to church and you to lead the example by worshiping and praising and taking notes and taking interest and loving each other. But if all you do is walk out of these doors and you backbite and you gossip about somebody sitting next to you, why would they want to come back? Numbers 14:36. Those who'd returned, these were the spies, and made all the congregation. Those who'd returned made all the congregation grumble against him by bringing out a bad report concerning the land. It's really interesting wording, Numbers 14:36. It said, they made the congregation grumble because they brought about a bad report. The spies had started complaining, and then the whole congregation picked up on it. And the sin of complaining is so contagious. It spreads like wildfire. You get one disgruntled complainer, and it won't be long before it spreads to many. I'm fairly certain that if there weren't even giants in the land, that the Israelites were so good at complaining that they would have found something else. They would have come back and said, hey, you know what, Moses? I didn't see any some milk and honey flowing out of any rocks. This isn't what God promised. Are we still going to have to till the ground and plant stuff? I thought it was just going to be flowing in this land. But we aren't any better. This is from a top 10 list of complaints about leaders. In no order, I'm going to read four of them to you. They're controlling. All the decisions, and this is the description behind it, all the decisions are decided and announced. No one gets to provide input. On the same list, they're indecisive. These leaders can't make a decision. And everyone waits and waits, and everything stalls. They're lazy. It's not do as I do, it's do as I say, because I'm not doing anything. On the same list is this: they're distracted. Sometimes leaders appear so busy that those trying to follow don't believe they have ever have their full attention. If it's not one thing, we'll complain about the other. Don't you find it interesting on a top 10 list by a secular survey, we'll either complain about them being too busy or too lazy? They're making too many decisions or not enough decisions? See, this is the problem with the attitude of complaining. If you don't get your heart adjusted and be thankful for what God has given you, then you will find something to complain about, whether you are right or wrong. And so we come to church with the same attitude we try to do in the workplace and in home, and we nitpick, and God is not pleased by that. How would you respond to statements like these? Did you see the offering total was down last week again? I heard the elders had a concern about Pastor's sermon last week. Something seemed a bit off with the praise team. Did you see the color they picked out for the new carpet? You know, if you have no opportunity to bring a disagreement to an end, it is just as bad to get caught in the middle of a conflict. People often are looking for allies in their complaining. Very rarely do people want to complain and just be avoided and neglected. They want you to chime in with them, and then you get this little band of people together. Proverbs 6:19, this is one of the seven things that God hates: one who spreads strife among brothers. There's not a single one in this room, whether you have a problem with complaining or not, that when another person engages in this sin of complaining, that we miss its ugliness. But let me tell you something. Trust me, it does not look any better on you than it does on them. I'm going to make a strong statement. Yes, I've made a few this morning, but really I've just been truthful. When Israel complained against Moses and Aaron, they were really calling into question God's ability to carry out his will. Was God using Moses? Here's the statement. When we complain about church or how it is run, we are calling into question God's sovereignty. Philippians 2:14 in the Amplified renders the verse this way: do everything without murmuring or questioning the providence of God. I'm so happy they picked up on that when they were translating it. Do everything without questioning the providence of God, because that in effect is what murmuring and griping and complaining is. It's saying, God, I'm not satisfied with the lot you've given me. I'm not satisfied with the church that I have to attend. I'm not satisfied with the pastor. I'm not satisfied with the worship team. I'm not okay with the direction it's going. God, you are missing something. I deserve better than this. Unfortunately, the church is not perfect. Not one church, not Tridestone either. But where do you see in Scripture that we ought to complain about the problems that you see and about everything wrong in the church until others fix it? Why don't we rather have a prayer attitude and ask God for patience? Matthew 12:36-37, but I tell you that every careless word that people speak, they shall give an accounting for it in the day of judgment. For by your words will you be justified. Ouch. And by your words you will be condemned. James 5:9, do not complain, brethren, against one another, so that you yourselves may not be judged. Behold, the judge, capital J, is standing right at the door. Do you know that we are not even supposed to complain while we're in tribulation? Romans chapter 5. And yet, we get so disgruntled about what Judy wore to church last week. 1 Peter 4:9, be hospitable to one another without complaint. Do all things without complaining, church. Do all things without complaining. Cook without complaining. Change diapers without complaining. Drive without complaining. Clean. Work. Study. Serve in the church without complaint. Pray without complaining. Praise without complaining. See, I used to think that people complained because they had a lot of problems. But I've come to realize this: people have a lot of problems because they complain.